everybody, and welcome to another episode here at the Damage Report. Big ol' Friday show. We're gonna close out the week with what we do. Errands, as in taking out the trash and welcoming the non-trash, Brett Ehrlich. How's it going, Brett?
Oh, I love errands. I'm your little errand guy. Send me off to do mindless tasks. That's what vacation's been about for me, and I love it.
You are now off of your vacation?
I'm not gonna do Sunday stream on Sunday. I'm just gonna take every day until Monday to just decompress. It's been crazy not following the news in that I realize there's so many things that I'm happy, like I do care about them, but I'm happy that I'm not like filtering through the news at every waking moment and that I can catch up on rewatching Entourage, which I've done.
Weird use of your time. Although I have watched House like 5 times. Anyway, okay, well then you, man, there's so much that you don't know about. I mean, you've been off for 2 weeks?
I've been off for 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
I have been off for 2 weeks.
So you still think that like there's gonna be infrastructure and Facebook is a thing, but yeah, neither of those things are true. And so I'm gonna reveal so much truth to you and welcome you back into this dark reality.
Thank you for doing that. Usher me back. Usher me across the river Styx.
That's all I've ever wanted to do. That's in my Twitter bio. Anyway, we've got a lot over the course of the 90 minutes that we're gonna be talking about. We've got fun with Katie Porter. We've got the media and how they're trying to pin all the nonsense that's going on progressives. We've got Meta. We've got anti-vaxxers. You know what else we have? We have a holiday coming up. That's Halloween, and it's gonna inform my garbage person. But there's a second holiday that you may not know about, and that is the birthday of Sophie, our producer. So when I make vague references to screwing over my producers by not doing content that they have produced, sometimes it's Marissa, especially the videos that she edits. But a lot of the time, it's Sophie. Did Sophie edit the evangelical story? She did, right? I think she did. So we have this story that's been at the bottom of our rundown the whole week. It's never made it on. As a birthday present to her, I'm not necessarily gonna do it, but I'm gonna say that it might happen. Happy birthday, Sophie.
Happy birthday, Sophie, our original LBC. By the way, I do wanna say, I know this is Sophie's day, but credit to Marissa for like acting out responses to John off camera, like.
Yeah, because I can't hear her. Yes, thank you, Marissa. We'll get to your birthday when it happens. But happy birthday, Sophie. Sophie's got the day off. Hope that she's having fun. Really hope that she doesn't know that we're wishing her a happy birthday, because that would imply that she's watching the show and you shouldn't be doing that. But anyway, we'll have her back soon enough. Thank you for everything that you do, Sophie. Okay, she told me she will be watching. Oh, hi. Anyway, okay, so with that, we have a lot that we're gonna be talking about. Feel free to, first of all, hit the like button. Second of all, share the stream. Third of all, if you wanna send us comments and stuff, you know what's happening. We'll have updates for you about what's going on the network a little bit later on. I just wanna give you one now, actually. So it's the power panel today. I'm gonna be leading the first hour. Cenk Uygur will be there. That's always what's true. You know what's not always true? That we have an in-studio guest. And you know what's even less likely to be true? That it's gonna be Senator Nina Turner. Me and Cenk and Nina Turner in person. They said it couldn't be done, and for like 2 years it couldn't be. But now it will be, so definitely stay tuned for that. With all that said, Brett, are you ready to talk about some stuff?
I'm just so happy I didn't know about the logistics of that. Like,
I don't know about the logistics either.
I'm so glad I wasn't here for that.
Yeah, exactly. You don't even know who Nina Turner is. You've been gone for so long. Anyway, okay, let's jump into our first of many fun topics to close out the week for you. Congress got to grilling oil executives, and there's great commentary from a number of individuals. We're gonna spotlight a lot of that, but I wanna start with Katie Porter, because Katie Porter, you know what she loves? A good grilling. She's a true American. You know what else she loves? Props. And I love that she loves that. Take a look at this video.
We've heard a lot about future plans for investment in renewable energy today. Ms. Watkins, Shell's 2020 annual report called for between $19 and $22 billion in near-term spending. I'm representing that with this container of M&Ms. Each M&M represents about $50 million in spending. Ms. Watkins, how much has Shell said it will spend in the near term on oil, gas, and chemical operations?
I think you just said we're going to be spending between $18 and $20 billion this year.
That's near term on total spending. How much on oil, gas, and chemical operations?
We're going to be spending...
Well, according to your annual report, you said you're going to spend $16 to $17 billion for oil, gas, and chemical, with another $3 billion for marketing. How much is Shell spending to spend on renewable energy?
This year, we'll be spending between $2 and $3 billion.
$2 and $3 billion on renewables and energy solutions. In your testimony, you said, quote, meeting the demand for reliable energy while simultaneously addressing climate change is a huge undertaking and one of the defining challenges of our time.
Yeah, so it's going to be hard to meet that defining challenge with just a little handful of M&Ms. So
question,
I like that as a
though, John, what kind of M&Ms were those? Because if those were peanut butter M&Ms, then we're in a whole new ball game, you know, because that is more... moment, like gram for gram, it's packed with more flavor. If those are pretzel M&Ms, those are more valuable M&Ms. So who knows? If I was playing like poker with M&Ms instead of poker chips, I feel like if they were pretzel M&Ms, those would be worth like 500. So I don't know.
That would also be a good metaphor if you were grilling an oil executive. Also, there's no way pretzel M&Ms are worth more than peanut butter M&Ms. Let's be clear about that. But I love that as a visual element. I just want a mason jar with a handle full of M&Ms. That just seems like a great idea going into Halloween weekend. They would not last long.
John anyway, would Muppet Katie Porter- eat those. John would Muppet drink that thing. You know how like they just Cookie Monster just like shoves the cookies and they go God, everywhere. That's how John would drink the stein of M&Ms.
He's so great. There'd be no money left over for renewable energy, unfortunately. That said. Some of you think, okay, I like the grilling, but I'm not really into the sweets. Well, don't worry, she's got another angle. Take a look at this.
Rice were 1 acre, that would be 479 pounds of rice. The American Petroleum Institute even opposed pausing more leasing on our lands. They even sued to stop it because apparently this acreage wasn't enough. Mr. Wirth, you serve on the American Petroleum Institute's executive committee. Do you support a pause on new oil and gas leases on federal land?
Congresswoman, access to resource in this country is essential to ensure the energy security of our country and-
Reclaiming my time. Mr. Lawler, do you support a pause?
The administration and its our- It's our hope that the pause ends soon. We think it's important to go forward.
My time. Thank you for your answer. The answer there is no. Mr. Woods, do you support a pause on new federal and gas leases?
No.
Ms. Watkins, do you support a pause on new federal and gas leases?
No, I do not, because I think it's important.
You already have 13.9 million acres. This is equivalent to Maryland and New Jersey combined. How much more do you need? How much more acreage? You have two of our 50 states at a price that makes the Louisiana purchase look like a ripoff, and you're not even using it. What more do you need? Iowa, Colorado, Virginia? Our public land belongs to the American people.
That's pretty strong. I love the references to the Louisiana purchase. That's pretty good. She's like dumping it out as she's doing it. The most surprising part for me, Brett, was actually that there were a couple of the responses that just said no. They were willing to just say blatantly, no, yeah, we love having, you know, two states. We would, yeah, throw in Colorado. That would be perfectly fine. Why would they be opposed to it? So there was actually a little bit of honesty there that I wouldn't have expected.
Yeah, so a couple things when you're looking at the responses from the oil executives, the ones who get mad that they're being asked any questions just really sums up their default setting. Their default setting is two things. One, when the ones who just say no are like, I go before Congress and have very frank conversations all the time. I tell them what I want. I give them the money that through donations, and then I get what I want from them. So I don't see what the problem is. The other thing is they know, I mean, their expertise in as lobbyists and as CEOs is the boring and the mundane and the inaccessible. So the C-SPAN type boring monotone of those kinds of hearings is their specialty, and they just go and they do it and they check the box, and then they, while they're in town, maybe they'll go and you know, drop by somebody that they need influence of. They need influence. But Katie Porter has kind of mastered with these things that are kind of like your teacher teaching you a really fun lesson that even though you thought it was corny at the time, in this case, maybe with all the grains of rice, you're like, I'm definitely gonna remember it though.
Yeah.
You know, definitely. Down the line. And some of those CEOs just kind of sauntered into that unknowingly. The one that I just want to point out is the guy who said that we really, you know, access to resource. And when they say that, that's that makes me so sad when they say a noun a way you wouldn't say it, which means that that's like their industry talk, where they have and they've decided to message around it and to communicate around it within the industry. They call land resource. Or gas resource, not resources, the resource, it's resource. And then the other thing they do is talk about our energy security, which is a carefully crafted messaging tool in order to make you think, no, we're not. And then this is where the rubber meets the road on like the Trump populace. We're not confiscating your land for these purposes. That we are creating energy security for generations to come. Never mind that there's now 5.5 earthquakes in Oklahoma because of all of this. We want that resource and it's never enough. They're Hexas from Fern Gully.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, they said they were providing energy security, not tectonic stability. So I guess they've created a little bit of wiggle room, which goes along well with the fact that the floor is always wiggling now. So anyway, great job there by Katie Porter. The one, if I could just throw a little bit of like, when she does stuff like this, she does a great job, but it is going to lead to copycats from far less clever representatives, especially on the right. And I'm not looking forward to, you know, the rigatoni demonstration by Lauren Boebert or something like that. They're not going to be good. Anyway, let's jump into some of these others. Representative Ilhan Omar had her chance to talk to the oil executives, and she was pretty clear about what she wanted, actually. Take a look.
Donations, with 80% of those donations going to Republicans. In 2020 alone, the industry made $139 million in donations to candidates and committees, of which 84% went to Republicans and mostly climate deniers. It is yet another reason we need to get the fossil fuel money out of our politics. Fossil fuel companies have polluted our air, land, and water for profit, despite knowing the devastating impact it has on our companies. It seems like you all have achieved that victory of leading the public with this information. And as one of my colleagues said earlier, I hope that you are ashamed of the future that you contributed for your children and for ours. And I ask all of you to resign.
They're not gonna do that, unfortunately. But yeah, look, saying stuff like that in theory, pointing out that, you know, for short-term profit, they're absolutely wrecking not just the world, but the world that their descendants will have to inhabit, should have some effect. But at this point, it's much like natural selection. These CEOs have already been through the ringer. They have no human empathy left. They have no shame left. But at the very least, it makes for good moments where the public can be exposed to this and think about the relationship that our government has with fossil fuels, that our society has with fossil fuels, and maybe question it a little bit more. So while she's not going to get her actual goal, which is them resigning, I like the focus of Ilhan Omar there.
Yeah, it's fine. I feel like there's got to be some more. This is so depressing. You know, you ever like happen across a thought and you're just like, wow, that's sad that I don't think saying that, you know, it's right, it's true and everything, but I don't think like leaving a bad environment for your children in the future. How sad is it that that's not a very like effective talking point?
Yeah.
Like it's so, it's like, it reminds me of Eddie Izzard when he says like, you kill two people or whatever, it's like bad. And it's a tragedy, but like you killed 100,000 people. Wow, you must get up very early in the morning. It's just so huge, you can't really wrap your mind around it. That's why I think like specific local stories of contamination and pollution and lack of regulation, and then looking at like something that people can understand on a large scale is the, you know, wanting to keep a job until their kids are in college or out of college. And if, you know, that's one aspect of it. And the other, I want to go back to like Katie Porter and the M&Ms. Just like when you think about the money that they're investing in renewable energy, Joe Manchin, his argument for removing most of the climate ordinances and regulations and initiatives from the Build Back Better plan was that companies do this anyway. He says, well, you know, if you look at these companies over the years, they've changed and they've gone to like more into more renewable. They got 30% renewable. Yeah, but look at what they're investing and what they're spending. If, you know, if speech is money, they're not putting their money where their mouth is.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And while I agree, renewable energy is it's constituting a greater percentage of our electricity, our energy production, it is doing that because thankfully it's becoming more cost effective. So, but that doesn't mean that we can't help. Free markets are great or whatever. Oil never had to totally go it on their own. We've subsidized them for decades and decades and decades. So don't tell me that it can't, especially when it advances a social and ecological goal, that the government can't help out a little bit along the way, especially if it creates an entire industry here where we can start to be competitive with countries like China in terms of, you know, solar panel production and things like that. Yeah. Okay, let's go to one more. In Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in speaking with these dirty energy CEOs, wanted to focus on a very important part of this process. A lot of them are talking about the fact that these companies are involved in lobbying and all that, but now is a crucial moment where we have the reconciliation bill. In theory, it could have done a lot that has to do with energy production and those sorts of things, and a lot was weeded out. And we know that lobbying was a big part of why that happened. So here she is talking about that coordination between industry and some of the so-called moderates.
Have you participated in any calls with members of Congress throughout this process of reconciliation and infrastructure?
I have.
You have. Are political donations ever discussed during your calls with members of Congress?
No, they're not.
That might even be true, Brett. It might even be true that they don't talk about that. Of course, the fact that they don't specifically mention it seems kind of needless because nobody doesn't understand how this works or what the stakes are, the financial stakes for representatives. But at least he is clear that he has been putting pressure on them. And we're gonna talk later on in the show about it's been so clear some of the personal financial interests of those who have been interfering with Biden's agenda. I'm glad that she's making it clear that relationship exists, the effect that it has. I wish that more of the talk about this was focused on that rather than just on dollar amounts or, you know, the sort of games of Game of Thrones style back and forth about different factions fighting and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's Congress's money. That's what it is. It's unfortunate that, right, what you want is to give the kind of, you know, when AOC is talking to this guy, she's really invoking that leaked video where the guy brags about having conversations with Joe Manchin.
Exactly.
And she wants to keep that through line going. And that's something that I think a lot of people can really identify with. It's like, even if they're not talking about it, that is a perfect question where everything about it seems creepy. And that's what they tell lawyers to do is, you know the question and you can ask a certain question where no matter what the answer is, it's still good for you. And if he says no, he just seems like he's lying. And he is meeting with members of Congress when he's there. And it's just so strange to me. And the thing that really, like the central theme that gets to me and depresses me is that there are, you know, so many things that so many people want, but Congress still keeps finding a way not to give it to them. And the reason is that they'd rather give those taxpayer funded subsidies to the people who give back with campaign donations rather than the people who give back with votes. Because for so many people who are out there voting, they just don't feel like there's an alternative. And there's this false sense of security that a lot of people have where they're like, I'm going to blame it on Congress as a whole, not my congressperson, because what the hell else am I supposed to do?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and especially in certain cases, like it, yeah, it's been fairly clear on some of the individual components, whether it's, you know, some of it has to do with this, like the $150 billion for incentivizing energy production that doesn't involve coal and that sort of thing. It's very clear who was against that. Negotiations on prescription drug prices and things like that. And that's why we've tried to make sure that people know, you know, where those interests lie. It's not the only people that had an effect, and it's harder to identify the lobbyists, but we need people to understand this process. And unfortunately, the media has kicked up a lot of sand, a lot of dust. It's been hard for some people, I'm sure, to follow it. You see the polls of, you know, how much people know about this process, and it is shockingly low considering it's been the biggest domestic news story for like a solid 3 months. But see what happens. Okay, we are gonna take our first break though. When we come back, we will still be talking about some of this, basically infrastructure, but I wanna focus on some of the media narratives around the current state of the negotiations and try to give us an idea of where things might end up going. Once the process is done, what is the takeaway going to be from some of the media? We'll have that and a lot more for you after this. Anyway, everybody, thank you for being here. I've got a few things I wanna let you know through the course of the show, so I'm gonna distribute it a little bit. First of all, if and only if you watch this live stream at youtube.com/TheYoungTurks starting on November 1st, that will no longer be available. The Damage Report will no longer be playing live at The Young Turks. It will be playing live at youtube.com/TheDamageReport. And literally everywhere else that it streams will remain the same. So don't worry about that. You just won't be able to watch it at The Young Turks. I know that what you're thinking, it's like a corporate thing. No, I just hate those jerks and I just won't have my show there anymore. So just go to youtube.com/TheDamageReport and subscribe. And with that, Brett, let's jump into some stuff. We don't know exactly what's gonna happen with the reconciliation bill. Will it pass? Will they separate them? And then one or maybe none of those will pass. We don't know, but I am already seeing a lot of signs, and I'm sure many of you are already worried about the possibility that regardless of what happens, progressives are gonna be blamed for it not being arbitrarily better. And I've seen that coming up in a lot of different forms. Some of it is explicit, blaming progressives for things. Others is in what is not said. And I have versions of both that I wanna show you. So first of all, I found a few little sections from a recent New York Times article about the negotiations that I had a problem with for a number of different reasons. One had to do with the introduction of the billionaire tax. They said, the need to roll out new tax proposals stems largely from the concerns of business groups. I'm glad that you identified that. And moderate Democrats hate that term. They've never had to justify it. I hate that they can just say that. And they do say they effectively killed Mr. Biden's initial plan to raise the corporate tax rate to pay for his clean energy and social policy initiatives. Other ideas proposed by the White House, including raising the top marginal tax rate for the wealthiest taxpayers and doubling the capital gains tax, have also been jettisoned. So that is hardly the worst that I've seen from the media. But again, anything specific to motivation, why exactly they killed it, allowing people to understand what is driving some of these incredibly powerful politicians has largely not been a focus, unless that is the only thing that the article is about. So it is not that there hasn't been some coverage of the fact that, for instance, Joe Manchin owns a coal company. It's just that you get the article about him owning it, and that's that. For the most part, anything else having to do with him and environmental policy no longer references that. We'll identify that he has it, but we're not going to besmirch the good senator by implying that it might be influencing his decisions later on. And so I've got other examples I'm gonna give, but Brett, what are you thinking so far? I know that you've been out for 2 weeks, you haven't been following this every day.
I've been following it. This always seems to happen. Basically, I think my full take on it is, you cannot understate or overstate, I forget the right way to say it, but like you're always gonna be wrong and play it too cool when you think of how lazy people in media are. They are so lazy. They know it already. They take new facts and they put it into their old, easy, tried and true framings. And even though a lot of them feel like they like this new progressive instinct in folks in like actual places of power who can wield it, they still at the end of it say things like that frustrate you, like moderate. Yeah. Like moderate is not moderate for the rest of the country. It is psychotically to the right. Most people want what's in the Build Back Better plan because of course they do. And you would hope that they would have to justify, I love that word, justify why they're saying no to these things and have to look into the faces of people that these last minute, these things that seem like they're at the last minute, I'm sorry, I just didn't make it into the bill, but maybe over the long run, they never thought they'd get into the bill. You'd think they'd have to look in the eyes of the people that affects and tell them exactly why it happened, but they don't. It just is one of those things they want you to come away from saying like, well, there was a compromise. And at the end of the day, compromise is good. Everyone's gonna feel kind of crappy. Yeah. But when they say they're compromising, who are they compromising with? It's fine if Joe Manchin owns a coal company in theory. Maybe it's fine for someone from West Virginia to have some kind of business interest that represents West Virginia. But if and only if his behavior as someone running that business actually translates to what's good for West Virginia now and in the future. But it doesn't. It always seems to just translate to what's best for Joe Manchin's bottom line and the bottom lines of his kids. Because the things that end up falling out of these plans are things that benefit literally his family. TYT has a new article up about how Joe Manchin is already making money off of this.
Yeah.
Already.
Already. Yeah. No, you're totally right. And yeah, like in theory, some of this could represent, but like even with, let's say that he as a coal CEO could represent the coal industry, which I think that is incredibly questionable. Even if you assume that literally everyone who works in coal in the country works in West Virginia, which isn't true, it's just tens of thousands of people. West Virginia has 1.8 million people. It is such a tiny swath of their population. But anyway, I want to get to some more issues that I have with the media. So here is them talking about the tax once again. If enacted, the taxes would likely apply to fewer than 1,000 companies and individuals. That is a good thing to know. I'm glad that they did that. But the breakneck speed at which changes are being considered and crafted is rattling business groups and some powerful Democrats who have expressed concern about the consequences of moving so quickly. So it is not that what they're saying is untrue. They have expressed concerns about the consequences of moving so quickly, but that is not their principal concern. It's not that I'm worried that you're gonna tax us too fast. It's that they're worried they will be taxed at all.
They were untaxed wildly fast.
Yeah, exactly. This is making it a process thing, a procedure thing. It's not, it's an economic thing. It's a class thing. The powerful Democrats aren't like, well, you know, I'm totally cool with like regulating the hell out of these companies. I just want to take a couple of weeks. That's not true at all. That is not what is happening. And so people reading this will come away thinking, well, they seem reasonable. I mean, after all, they just want to pump the brakes a little bit. No, they want to kill it because they never want them to be taxed literally at all.
But now, yeah, so it is always going to be the case that the people running these companies don't want to pay higher taxes. And they will always present their argument as though it threatens the life of their company. And then they'll say our employees. Meanwhile, their success, those CEOs personally, did not rise commensurately with that of their employees. And any time, and this is their move that's psychotic. The central theme of their narrative for America is this entrepreneurial spirit will triumph no matter what. And they're trying to convince you that that entrepreneurial spirit that they're so proud of will disappear the minute the tax rate goes back to less than it was before their last tax cut. Oh. And that's insane. They will always, to their credit, and that's how I frame it to them when I talk to them. No, to your credit, you're such a great entrepreneur that we will be able to have roads and bridges and programs that every other country that people live longer in have, and you'll still be successful. And you'll be able to use that entrepreneurial spirit to overcome the challenge of a fair tax rate.
Yeah, 100%. Well, a broader blamey thing. So this is not identifying what's really going on, but then there's just outright blaming the progressives. So Stephen Collinson on CNN says, "And will what is now a much diminished measure so disappoint Democratic base voters and independents that it will fail to have the significant political impact the party needs to stave off a Republican rout in next fall's midterm elections? One thing is for sure, if progressives don't eventually come around, even if they are dissatisfied with the compromises made to get the package through the Senate, they could inflict huge damage on Biden's already wobbling presidency." Okay, in some sense they'd be doing that, but they're the ones on Biden's side. That's like saying, okay, I understand that I buried three daggers in your back and you're currently face down on the pavement, but if you don't get up and finish that marathon, you've hurt your time. Well, kind of, but the daggers are an important part of this, and I feel like they should really be more of a focus of this marathon commentary.
They're right. I mean, he's right, but it's sad and it's nefarious. Well, in that giant pukeograph of like sad framing, it is true that if the progressives are like, say, actually, hey, everyone in our voting block, that we got great stuff out of this. Mm-hmm. And if they're able to convince people that we got great stuff out of this, that will help Biden's already wobbling presidency. The downside is that's a lie. They'd have to lie to everyone. And you have the more savvy, more interested voters in those blocks, the people who are reading news about this very stuff every single day, 700 times a day. And while you can get that narrative across the finish line with moderates who are like, I don't know, I guess whatever, I just want people to get along in Washington, you can't sell that to people. And that's why, I mean, from what I've been following, there's been a lot of pushback. I mean, yeah, they say that Jayapal kicked Nancy Pelosi out of the meeting and she walked away without any words to say. Is that going to follow through to votes that are no's? Maybe, and we'll see about that. But that's the one I just put out, I think, is the decision that's facing a lot of progressive legislatures, the legislators who are kind of looking around to see whether they need to put air quotes around the word progressive.
Yeah. And look, it's like if they pass what, and God only knows what's actually in the bill, they change every 5 minutes. But if they do, they will have some things that they can go back and say, we got this stuff, but they probably also know in the back of their mind, it is, as you know, for all of the other problems with this section, also true that it probably will not be enough to actually do something. It could have been, and by the way, someone noted they're on Biden's original side, not the side that he's on now, which is true. That's what I mean. They were pushing for the actual things that he promised. And by the way, the things that would in theory be necessary for them to win the midterms. If they passed the original bill that had been talked about, that we know was wildly popular, they would have a very good chance, I think. There's already issues with gerrymandering and voter suppression, and the inherent cycle of the Senate would be difficult for them. But they would have a chance. This is not providing them a chance. So not only were the progressives more true to the promises that were made in the last election cycle, they also had their eyes on what's necessary to win in the next one. And I just want people to note that and understand that going into it. Next year is going to be really, really rough. It is not going to be a surprise to people who've been watching this and a few other programs. Okay, now let's move to something very different. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal got a lot of uncredit, including from people like me, for being willing to publish a letter from Donald Trump or from other people with his signature on it, claiming that the Pennsylvania 2020 election had been stolen. They did this as an op-ed. Here's a picture from it. President Trump responds on Pennsylvania's 2020 election. I am not going to go through all of what's in it because it is all nonsensical. I will show you that it's basically a long list of numbers without citations. So things like 57,000 duplicate registrations is two entries above the fact that there were nearly 60,000 new first-time voters who were older than 70. Both of those things are just listed as proof that the election was stolen. There are new voters, ergo, the election was stolen. So it was nonsensical. There was no fact-checking. There was no context. There was no commentary. There was nothing. They just printed lies from the guy who tried to overthrow democracy and is almost certainly going to do it again. Now, they are angry. not about what they did. They're angry about the fact that people criticized them. So they put up a new op-ed, and it's called "The Facts on Trump's Fraud Letter. His 2020 Monomania is News, and it reflects on his fitness for 2024. So don't expect any apologies. They get quite snooty about it, saying the progressive parsons of the press are a flutter that we publish. Don't talk like a real person, honestly. Like, can you just talk like a person who's actually exists in the real world anyway? Then we published a letter to the editor Thursday from former President Trump objecting to our editorial, pointing out that he lost Pennsylvania last year by over 80,000 votes. We trust our readers to make up their own minds about his statement, and we think it's news when an ex-president who may run in 2024 wrote what he did, even if, and perhaps especially if, his claims are bananas. So there's two things there. So first of all, we trust our readers to make up their own minds about a statement that we will go on to say is riddled with lies is an interesting conception of how a newspaper is supposed to function. I get that it is an op-ed, but I will also assure you that other people who were not the president do not generally get to blatantly lie in their op-eds either. There is an expectation that in newspapers, even something like the Wall Street Journal, that if they print it, it is in some way verifiable, but they're moving away from that ethos. And they're saying it's news that he's lying. Well, it's not new that he's lying. You know that he's trying to end democracy. You can put up an article about that. You can talk about his claims, but you don't have to just print them without fact checking. That's my point.
It's a tough decision for the Wall Street Journal. It's also like an old decision. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this one's going to be different. The fact that Donald, what's new about it? Yeah, I agree with it. Like with you, like there, what's new about him repeating the same old lies over and over again, but this time in the Wall Street Journal? The only difference is now it's in the Wall Street Journal. And I totally am fine with them printing terrible opinions in their op-ed section. That's what it's for. It's for, here's a columnist, and here's on this side, you know, there's the editorial page, and there's the opposite of the editorial page. And the opposite of the editorial page is full of opinions from carefully curated opinions that the editorial board has decided to include on that side of the paper. But they don't have to include everyone. And there is a temptation, we all understand, because he was the president of the United States. But like, your job is to curate that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of stuff that's out there that's said by important people. Do you need to put it in your newspaper? The answer is no. And if you trust them to make up their minds, that's fine. I honestly don't think this is gonna change anyone's mind. I don't think anyone's opening the Wall Street Journal and being like, oh, you know, now 4 years after I met him as a politician, I'm gonna look at Donald Trump and be like, oh, now he's starting to make sense. It's either like, there he is again telling the truth, and there he is, or there he is again, thanks for the tax cut. I'm glad you're off in the middle of nowhere about to eat farts or whatever you do on a daily basis. Like, I'm fine and happy.
Yeah.
Haha.
You might be right. That is certainly possible. To one of your early points, I would say, and again, they are free to do anything, but I think in general, the idea of op-eds is that, yes, you can publish bad opinions. I would argue here they're not just publishing bad opinions, they're publishing bad facts. Facts that they say are not true.
They can do it, but typically they won't print an op-ed if there's lies in it. They won't do that. That's what the editorial board typically skims those pieces for, to be like, we're not printing that because that's just false. Your opinion, we know the difference between opinions and facts. Your facts have to be accurate. And this is an exception in this case. Now, there's a difference between people who are taking facts and spinning them and misrepresenting them, but there's still facts in there. But his stats are just nonsense and stupidity. Exactly. And it's like a child. You just kind of let them speak nonsense, and it's like, I guess I love, you know, it's my kid. What am I supposed to do? It's the president. Former president. What am I supposed to do? The answer is, bop him one.
Yep. By the way, they go through a couple of the claims that he made, including one claim. The only reference they could find for what he said was a one-time appearance by Lindsey Graham on cable TV. He was apparently citing Lindsey Graham. Yeah. And they point that out, and they say that the number doesn't appear to be true. Okay. So, but was that not an issue before? Apparently
they,
not.
They point out that Lindsey Graham's camp has said this is not true.
Yeah, just exactly. But make it more clear. You need to read the second op-ed to even know that. They go on to say, Mr. Trump is making these claims elsewhere, so we hardly did him a special favor by letting him respond to our editorial. Okay, look, I'm not saying that like being in the Wall Street Journal op-ed section's the best thing ever, but I think you're being a bit too humble. I've heard crazy people yelling stuff on the street. Publishing them in the Wall Street Journal seems like kind of a special favor by comparison. We offer the same courtesy to others we criticize, even when they make allegations we think are false. Sure, maybe in some cases, but you do choose some and not others. And you are choosing to put these lies here. And they say that we're trying to censor Mr. Trump. Again, I'm not trying to censor anything. This isn't cancel culture. This is speech that I'm doing. You can tell because noises are coming out of my head. You can publish something and I and others can criticize it in the same way that you wouldn't be freaked out if you had an op-ed by Padma Lakshmi and I was like, hey, that's good. I'd be allowed to say that. Am I allowed to say that this one is bad? But they're freaking out as if having an issue with something is no longer allowed. I would argue that that is far more emblematic of what you claim cancel culture is than me expressing an opinion about a choice that you made. I didn't tell my viewers to no longer purchase the Wall Street Journal. I didn't pick it outside of their building. I'm pointing out that there's a problem with the fact that the Wall Street Journal thinks that going along with a guy who's on a path towards perhaps overthrowing our elections is just totally cool. It's not a special favor at all. You can do that. It's your business. You can do basically whatever you want, but I can criticize it. That's what I'm saying.
I love the idea of like, it just brings to mind all the stupid and lazy, half-assed, frequently contradicting like moves that conservatives have online. It's like, well, if you don't have it, that's cancel culture. If you do print it and you talk crap about it, it's still cancel culture because you're telling him he can't have that stupid opinion. Everyone else who calls out these stupid opinions, that the point of them is to get them out, period. And when you're complaining about them not getting out, they're getting out. All these terrible arguments that coincidentally, not so coincidentally, intentionally frame the discourse. And they still get out. They still are pervasive. And everything that they do is just, it's just so sad and predictable and crafted. And half the people who repeat them have no idea that they contradict another argument they made like 10 minutes ago.
Yep. 100%. Okay, everybody, it is almost meta time here at TDR. We're gonna take a little break, but then we're gonna dive into the future of what's awful on social media after this. Anyway, okay, everybody, reminder, the power panel in studio, Senator Nina Turner, Cenk Uygur, and myself. That's gonna be a lot of fun. The second hour will be Cenk, JR, and Ida Rodriguez is gonna be there. She's got an upcoming HBO Max comedy special, her first big HBO Max comedy special, Fighting Words, is gonna be streaming on November 4th. How exciting is that? Everybody at 280 obviously loves Ida, so you should definitely check that out. Also a reminder that if you'd like to produce content for Rebel HQ, go to tyt.com/careers. A lot of great people doing work there. You could be one of them. And with that, why don't we jump into our last story?
Starting today, our company is now Meta. Our mission remains the same. It's still about bringing people together.
Don't worry, it's a new name, but we're still gonna let you organize for an insurrection. We got you covered on that. It's just gonna be a meta-rection from now on.
Never say anyway. That word again. Jesus, John, that
makes me I like it. So that's Mark Zuckerberg, who is definitely, that's who I would choose to assist in the rollout of a product. And he's talking about the fact that Facebook's parent company is now Meta. Okay, I wanna get into a little bit of him talking about why it's awesome, what it's gonna look like. Take a look at this.
So let's start by exploring what different kinds of metaverse experiences could feel like, starting with the most important experience of all, connecting with people.
I love that because, and maybe it's an in-joke, but the fact that he's doing his best to pretend to have human emotions and then it drains away and he turns to a blue light, like, yeah, that's pretty much what I imagined your life was like, buddy. Thank you for showing us that, Brett.
It's so meta. It's It's, oh, we're good. I had one thing where I made a video for Facebook years and years ago. Like they, like I made something for some event they were having. And they, that process was the worst, dumbest process of my life. You can tell all the people that are around going like, this will be great. It'll be so exciting. It's so like, if you care about Mark Zuckerberg, you got to keep him from making videos like this. If you give a crap, if he's your friend, if you work with him, you have to keep him out of these videos because they're so bad. They're so sad. Like, I don't know. I read Rainbow's End's a cool movie or a cool book about basically you put contacts in and then you like say, I want all the world to look like medieval times. And then suddenly it does. And that's kind of what they're going for here, where you can change your reality around, you put skins over it. That's like metaverse type stuff. And this seems not like the company made by that upstart in the social network who wanted to make stuff cool, you know, like there's no Trent Reznor like cool hacking music behind this. This is the bad, this feels like the evil corporation.
Yeah.
In that movie.
He doesn't get that.
And like and that's not a criticism of the Ames. Like we haven't even gotten into that yet. This is about making a launch video, which I think is why this is trending more than them changing their name as a concept. And as a vision, it's just like, what are you guys doing in this?
Yeah, video? No, it doesn't. It's not to say that nothing like the metaverse or whatever, some aspect of it will ever become more popular than it is. I think that they are at this point massively overestimating people's interest in putting on like visors and things like that. That's just not a thing that people are ready for. I'm not saying that they never will, but There are other concerns too, which we'll get to really fast. I love some of the commentary about the name. AOC tweeted Meta as in, we are a cancer to democracy metastasizing into a global surveillance and propaganda machine for boosting authoritarian regimes and destroying civil society for profit. That pretty much nails it. Matt Blaze says, renaming Facebook Meta solves the same kinds of problems that renaming torture enhanced interrogation did. Which is totally true. And Jorge back on October 19th tweeted, just watch, the Facebook name change is going to be something like Meta or some BS.
So good.
And nailed it. It was in fact some BS. He says he has different reasons for why they're doing this. One is, well, it's like Facebook's an app, but it's also the company. That's confusing people. Why does it matter if people know what your parent company is named? That's not the reason.
It's different from Google changing their name to Alphabet, right? Mm-hmm. Google did change its name to Alphabet to avoid like a lot of trust issues and to split off a lot of their technological solutions that they've made that could be applied elsewhere than search and various other organizations. And Alphabet, they needed an umbrella for it. This is an umbrella to create their idea of the future of the internet, which is an all-inclusive social experience. That, by his own admission, allows you to be a total jerk by like clandestinely and without people noticing. Like, yep, I totally am listening to you, but you're looking over the side and answering emails at the same time.
Yeah, and we're not gonna have time, but he goes in depth about how, yeah, you could be like totally like looking at a person, but you're gonna be answering other stuff. That does not sound good to me. Like that is not, you are already making it so difficult for people to want to be around other people. Do you really need to do that for literally just looking at you?
It's so perfect for social network too. Like, cause they always do this thing where they solve the wrong problem. The problem you should be solving isn't like, how can I be rude to this person without them knowing it? Mm-hmm. But they think that's the problem to solve. No, you need to have more meaningful interactions with people. That's what you've said over and over again. There's nothing less meaningful than someone pretending they're listening to you, but at the same time answering another email. You guys have lost it. It's to appease his instinct, I think, just from like a character perspective, his instinct to be like that guy who can get away with being really alienating to people.
Yeah, he thinks everybody wants to go through these social interactions exactly as he does. I pray that he is not accurate in that. Anyway, we'll have more on this. We got some videos we'll show you like on another day or something. We'll see, maybe it'll end up being cool. I kind of doubt it. And if it ever does, I hope it's not Facebook's version of it. Anyway, we got more coming up. We're gonna take a short break, but if you're on Twitch and YouTube, we'll see you after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.